Accession number 210-64, wheel 5.
Noel, reel 5.
This feature across the valley was called pheasant, and for our point of view and for our benefit and for the observation from the front line point of view, all the hill features opposite were given code names. In the south end, in the Yongdong and the middle areas of the Samaishan Valley, the hills were called in such things with names like pheasant, duck, teal, and so on. Whereas in the northern area, they were given names like Wellington, Churchill, Eden, and so on. On this particular occasion, we were observing around the backside of this feature across the valley called it pheasant. And there was a Chinese working party transferring supplies, ammunition and stuff, petrol and what have you, up the hillside. Unbeknownst to them, we were able to see what they were doing. And they were transporting this stuff up the hillside in preparation for another bout of shelling and patrolling activity from their point of view. We were only engaged in so far as observing, but at this particular point it was something like 1,200 or 1,300 yards away. And I thought, well, the best plan in this case, rather than use the sniper rifle, we'd observe and get onto and report onto the local people, like the gunnery officer who had an OP not too far away from us, and then our own mortar people who were in the area. So we contacted the tank people and the fire point officer with the view to saying, we have a target and what would they like to do with it. So we discussed the target and they said, well, we can't see it from here. Can you give us a map reference or a bearing or something to go on and we'll take it from there? So we hadn't got the facility. I used to carry a map of sorts about with me, which was just a contour map, but there were no grid references or anything on it. There was just the code names of the hills and the features and the ranges to and from for our normal workaday purposes. So we decided that we'd send down a couple of tracer bullets for the firing point officer in his forward position and the tank officer on the hillside to see where the shot landed and then to give them a direction on this party. These people were carrying, as I said, supplies of ammunition and petrol or diesel or whatever it were up this hillside, and they were forming this line up. And so on a given signal, I decided to send a couple of tracer shells of the ball ammunition, 303 ball ammunition. We carried every other one now and again for observation purposes. We'd put a tracer down, which would glow and burn across the intervening valley. And I would be able to give them a direction as to where the shot had gone, and so they could pick up and organise their gunnery on into it and the tank fire. So we let the shot go, and as the bullet was going across the valley, you could see it glowing as it went across the valley. And I'd actually aimed at the centre of the group of people. I didn't think I had much chance of hitting anyone in particular. So I aimed at the centre of the group of people that was carrying these supplies up the hillside. And the shot must have struck a chap who was carrying either petrol or the diesel, and it burst into flames. And as it burst into flames, this chap sort of dropped it, and he was covered in the material himself, and he was burning on his clothes. He dropped it and fell backwards and started rolling down the hill. His colleagues then started chasing after him and trying to chuck dust on him and dirt and try and drown him out of that. And in the meantime, this petrol thing or diesel, whatever it were, formed a nice, bright, glowing, burning mass. The firing point officer for the gunneries on the hillside and the tank commanders had seen this, and they were able to engage this particular target. Even though at the first instance they'd never seen the target or wasn't aware the target was there. So this was one of the ways in which the sniping fraternity, the observation party part of it, would do their job, even though they didn't actually fire bullets.
Can you tell me about camouflage that was used?
When you're doing your training for sniper work and observation purposes, the idea is, of course, that you've got to go out and look like something other than what you really are. If you look like a bush or a tree or a clump of grass, well, that's fine, because the enemy wouldn't accept that as an enemy. So depending on what the terrain of the ground you're working on, it would change. If you're working in reeds and bulrushes or wet sort of equipment, you'd have to sort of camouflage your equipment and yourself up with this sort of garnishing from the area in which you're on. If you change your position or you went into a different area, then the need would be to camouflage your head and your shoulders and your rifle and everything with the foliage which is round and about your location that you're working in. As I say, whenever you change position, the thing in your mind is that the camouflage that you have now got on doesn't conform with where you are, and therefore it's a means of before you set out, you have to observe where you're likely to end up and where you're going to work towards and what is the conditions which are down there. And by putting scrimmage and the local vegetation or whatever it is that's in your area, you're able to conceal yourself to the point where the ordinary enemy looking at distance wouldn't see you. Even an enemy with the usual telescope or binoculars or high-powered observation species like the dog ears, and in the tanks they had a very similar type of thing but very, a bit stronger, you would then become part and parcel of the countryside or the area in which you're working. If you didn't do this, you stood out like a sore thumb. It was a typical observation training exercise where you said, well, if you're going to be working in trees, you've got to look like a tree. If you're working in bushes, you've got to look like a bush, and so on. But after all that's been said and done about garnishing and covering up with scrim and blackening your face to darken the image and everything, if you don't conform to what the area round about you is doing, you'll give your position away anyway. And the most common fault with all this is movement. It's no good getting camouflaged up and everything with all your trim and scrim and your local vegetation on you if you're insistent on popping your head up and down or moving your body, because movement in itself is one of the most giveaways in the natural world.
What do you mean by trim and scrim?
You start off with your tunic or your garb that you're wearing, usually an overall type of camouflage type jacket, and you stitch into it string and bits of webbing with a view to hanging onto all the way around your equipment, your clothes and on your head, your whatever cap, your helmet or whatever you're wearing. You've got these scrim furnishings, and then you add or take away whatever it is that you're using. You take away your greenery and put on brownery, if you like, on a brownscape. And these things, with being all attached to your equipment, would then allow you to redress your garb to conform with what type of ground you're covering. As I say, if you're working in an area which is covered with the gorse bushes or whatever, then the name of the game then would be to be using the gorse and whatever to conform with the surroundings that you're in. If you moved out of that area and then you moved into a plain area of ordinary greenery, this gorse scrim and protection that you'd got on would look out of place and it would show up. So it was a constant thing about conforming to the area in which you're going as to how you camouflaged yourself up.
Can you tell me about the equipment you use, the guns and the scopes?
We used the number four rifle, which was converted into a telescopic type rifle attachment. It had on the side of the receiver a set mount to allow a type 32 scope to be fitted to it. It had a cheek piece as such. When the army just had an ordinary rifle with the butt on it, a slimline cheek piece on the butt was something like 10 or 12 inches in length. In the sniper rifle version, they had an extra piece addition to it, allowing you to have a cheek piece for a rest for your head whilst you're using the scope from the rear, to just to raise your head up a little bit. It was called a cheek piece. This was then garnished over with Hessian or whatever and camouflaged in the normal way. Still allowed you to open and close your breech and see through the scope, which was then on top of your rifle and able to see the enemy. The power of these scopes varied from 4x to 7x, depending on which type of scope you'd got. But the general run of them was only about 4x times diameter. This was quite sufficient for even long-range shooting, because the crosshairs and the inner bits of the telescope allowed you to see the target quite clearly and give you some indication of the movement off in degrees from centre. To assist on this, you've got an ordinary scout-type telescope, which was collapsible. It collapsed down to something like 10 or 11 inches and kept in its case. When it withdrawn and the tubes were out, you'd got something like 20 times diameter magnification, which was more high-powered than your rifle. So you had a combination. You could use the one for spotting and the other one for actual shooting if you were working on your own. If you were working in pairs, your pair, whoever was the spare man with you, did the observation and you did the shooting, or if it changed about. The man that was the pair was doing the observation with a long telescope and directing you onto targets of interest. And then you had to pick them up with your scope on the rifle.
What about the question of aiming your shot and ballistics? Can you give some details about that, please?
Yeah. The rifle itself was calibrated, and the scope was calibrated so that you could go in excess of 1,500 yards. A normal rifleman, an experienced shot at that, would be conforming to his normal duty for shooting for his payment if he got something like a 4-inch group at 100 yards. This was the standard that was set in the army in those days, that your grouping capacity was important for the 303 ammunition, the ball ammunition that was used, and your number 4 rifle. Considering the ballistics of the number 4 ammunition, the 303 ammunition that was available in those days, the tighter you got your group, the more accurate would be your resulting shots. And the sniper fraternity, when they did the basic training, were encouraged and even trained into going a lot less grouping capacity than that. In fact, the pass-outs for your testing purposes, you were given a cigarette packet of something like 1.5x1 at 100 yards to hit with 5 shots. This was the quality in which they expected you to conform to, both rifle and ammunition and yourself as a shooter. If you multiply that by the number of hundred of yards that you're shooting at, you are then able to determine quite easily that a 2-inch grouper at 100 yards, if you like, would be a 20-inch grouper at 1,000 yards. So if you let a shot go, a good, accurate, well-aimed shot at 1,000 yards, you could get a direct hit somewhere in the area of 20 inches group, which would control, you say, the figure of a man. The quality of your shooting would then have to be of that nature to be able to record a hit. You couldn't guarantee at that range that you could pinpoint exactly where you were going to put your shot, simply because of the ballistics of the gun, the bullet, and the range at which you're shooting, the conditions of the day, whether it was dark, light, a little bit of wind on or whatever, you had to estimate as to exactly where you were going to put your shot. And even then, after you've done all your calculations, the best you could hope for would be for something like 18 to 20 inches group at 1,000 yards, which is quite good shooting. The present-day shooters are shooting at a 24-inch bullet at 1,000 yards under National Rifle Association shooting conditions.
So you're not aiming at a particular spot on the body?
Not at long range. You are aiming to hit the centre of the upper part of the man's whatever torso is showing. At closer ranges, you are then able to determine. At closer ranges, were 300, 400, 500, 600 yards, you're able to determine more precisely exactly where your shot's going to go. And this is what happened.
So where on the body would you aim at closer range?
The instructions were to aim at the head, simply because the head in that particular type of warfare was the only thing you could see of a man. Very often, when a man was camouflaged or concealed or in a low position on the ground, the rest of his body wouldn't be seen, but his shoulders and his head would. So he had the target of, rather than go for the shoulders and the upper part of the body, the outline and the silhouette of his head would be more distinct.
Did you ever get that close for a shot?
Yes, yeah, on several occasions.
And did you manage a hit?
Yes. As I say, with that end in view, you recorded exactly what happened. You put down in your report at the end of the day where you were, what you'd done, what you'd seen, what action you'd taken, with the overall view of the intelligence setup. If you came back and said you'd disposed of an enemy, they wanted to know a little bit of the details, of course, and you put down as briefly on your paper as you could so that the record was made. But in actual fact, as I said, going back to the Americans and the way that they, particularly in Vietnam, they used to call themselves reporting in as number of kills they've made. Some were claiming excessive amount of numbers of kills. If you like to sort of outline that by saying when there were 20 Chinamen chasing towards you and you shot 10 out of the 20 Chinamen, you could record 10 kills. But that isn't under the sniper type of code. You're talking about a term of an assault and an exchange of fire in which people are killed. And these could be sometimes badly aimed shots that still hit the enemy simply because they were fired in the right direction into a group of people. You're talking about the political, particular type of shot aimed at with a view to disabling or killing an enemy. And that's the difference between.
Did you ever operate against enemy snipers?
Yes.
Can you tell me about any of those?
I've operated and eliminated one or two enemy snipers on our frontage, simply because, A, we'd either seen them ourselves or it had been reported that our own troops were getting harassed by enemy snipers and they couldn't determine where they were from. In this particular event, we have to be called in, if you like, to expedite these people and to try and find out where they are and what they're doing, and to stop them harassing our own people, we have to counteract them. And there were one or two instances where this occurred. In one in particular, it was down in, I think it was in B Company area, in the Naishon area, before we moved down to the hook. They were getting harassed. Their frontage area, their slope of the hill, facing the open no man's land in between our positions and the Chinamen. They had their slit trenches in the normal way, sandbagged and proofed, and where they went into and out of their weapon pits, they had a wooden top bar, a lintel piece, supporting the roofing and everything for protection from shelled mortars and the like as much as possible. And it was whilst the men were doing their work during the day down this area that they were getting shot at, and the only way that they could find out where the enemy was coming from, because there were bullet holes in this lintel above where they were working, and the bullets were coming in from out of no man's land over the top of the palisades and hitting this woodwork. There were one or two casualties reported, but no fatalities, but one or two reported wounded. And we were called down, Seymour and myself, who was the chappie I used to work with quite a lot. We went down on this particular occasion to find out what it was all about and see if we could help. And we set up our positions down in this area with just in front of this lintel place where the board was. And we set up our gear under camouflage conditions and spent the morning and the rest of the day observing into no man's land and with a view to finding the enemy. It takes quite a while. It's a slow business until you, because if the men are doing like what we do, if they're as cautious as we are, they would take a long time to find. So it would necessarily be a longish sort of wait. To assist us in what we were doing, the lintel at the back of where we were, I had a pencil and put it into the in some of the holes that were in. We were able to put a pencil in. It gave you a direction as to where the shot had come from. So that was a bit of a clue. And then we concentrated our efforts in the direction of where these shots had arrived from. That same day, it got dark, around about 4 o'clock-ish, and we then decided that we'd have to make our way back to battalion headquarters and come back the next morning early-wise, because there was nothing else more to see. So the following morning, we came down before first light, and when the lads were coming back in after their normal nighttime activities, wiring and patrolling and the like, then they left us to our little section of trench on our own. And we started off as though we were trying to observe a man either coming off duty or going on duty from the Chinaman's side. And we were fortunate in able, because of this camouflage business again, like we mentioned before, if the camouflage is wrong or if there's movement, even when you've got camouflage on, if you're observing in the right area, you'll pick it up. And we did actually see this movement. It was either a form of relief coming in or out, or else the man was just a bit bored with himself and moved, stretched his legs or whatever, and moved his body. And we found what appeared to be a little hide about 400 yards away, just in front of our own lines, actually. We concentrated on this area for quite a while to see if we could get any distinct movement out of it. We got the long telescope, the 20 times diameter telescope, on which at that particular range would show it up in quite good detail. And then we actually saw what appeared to be a rifle pointing, a camouflage rifle pointing this way on a sandbag sort of setup on his bank, and also a person behind it occasionally moving his head as though he was examining documents or judging stuff. And because of this, a sniper oppo, Seymour, was able to say when this man was doing his thing, when he had his head radio, I could then see through my rifle sniper scope exactly where this aperture were, where the Chinaman was in. And when he said that the man was in the upright position, I let my shot go into the centre. And we're talking about 400 yards away, which at that particular range would be, if you're shooting well and your ammunition is in good order, you're doing something like a six-inch group. So that shot should have hit in the centre of the target, which it did.
How do you keep your ammo in good order?
Well, you keep it dry and clean, of course. You have no control over the quality of your ammunition you've got, except that you don't just throw it about willy-nilly. You do actually look after your ammunition in terms of keeping it clean and dry, and you have bandoliers or little pouches to put your ammunition in. We had, in those days, we had ammunition bandoliers holding 50 rounds. And whilst we didn't have the exact sniper ammunition which is used nowadays, there was a batch of ammunition called Black Spot Sniper, which was supposedly sent to reinforce the sniper rifles we were using. But I later found out that all the riflemen were using a very similar type of 303 ammunition anyway. So you couldn't claim that we were actually using a super-duper ammunition. We were actually shooting black spot ammunition supplied for use in Korea.
You were talking about the question of movements, but did you often have to move position?
Yeah.
And were there any techniques about concealing that?
If it was found necessary to move your position from A to B or to get a better view of a certain feature that you're interested in, the camouflage sequence that you'd go through would be A, to plan a move in little steps along the way, say move 10 or 12 yards to another location and from there to move to another and so on in little bounds or jumps to be able to get along and move your position. In doing so, you've got to take into account what sort of camouflage you'd got with you, how low the ground was, what cover from view from the enemy you'd got, and as to how you could work your way around to these other features. Sometimes it was necessary to go across open ground in a very slow sort of crawling belly and elbows and knees position, whereas on other occasions where there was little undulating folds and that in the ground, you could get along quite nicely by going down the folds. If the enemy could see you from the front, although they could see you from your own people could see you from the rear, that was quite in order. But the idea being that you should be at all times unseen by the enemy, so you could move from A to B, even if you were making a shot. If you made a shot in one area, you wouldn't necessarily confine yourself to that area all the time, because the next thing you know, that the enemy sussed out where you are in that particular area and reply. So in the event of this could happen and did happen occasionally, you'd moved yourself from that position and gone to another position. Where you're in a static position, where the strength of the position round about you was sufficient to be able to withstand any incoming shot other than a large thing like a mortar bomb or a shell, you were well under cover. This didn't sort of apply. But when you're actually moving from one place to another, you have to move in a sort of a surreptitious sort of change camouflage move, and it was slow and gradual, and you couldn't sort of rush these things.
And apart from all that, when you were retracting, were there any extra considerations?
Yes, you've got to try and, if you were in a position in front of your own area, you've got to try and recover from where you'd been to your own line without letting the enemy know that you were there. It's no good just sort of getting up and dashing back from where you'd just been into safety of cover. You'd have to work your way back in the same way. Is it to be seen and not to be seen, and that's basically what it's all about. The less that the enemy saw of you, the better it would be for your own safety. And because of this, people would say, well, you don't have any idea where the snipers are. They only know that the snipers are out in front of you somewhere, and they say, well, having done that, what have you seen when you get down there? But the name of the game was the fact that you were able to observe from a different viewpoint to what probably they were, and find out these items of news and information to be able to report back. On the strength of what you find out and report back is the makings of another plan to thwart the enemy in what he's trying to do. And on most occasions, the people in the front line, the normal laddies in the frontline troops who were doing these other jobs, didn't even know that you were there. As an outcome to this little episode of finding this man that was giving trouble to the troops down this B Company area, it's harking on the same sort of thing, was the fact that for some days or even weeks they'd had this trouble with these people shooting at them from out of no man's land. And we went down to sort it out, or do the best we could to find out the enemy and eradicate him from that area. The man that we shot was left in that particular position. There was no one going to go down into no man's land during the middle of the day and examine, because that would draw the fire from the enemy anyway, in any case. It was then left to be dealt with at night time, to go down and find this particular spot which we'd found and reported upon. And there was a corporal down there called Sergeant. His name was Sergeant, but he was a corporal in rank. Johnny Sergeant and his men. At the end of this particular exercise, when we dealt with the sniper, we just said, well, we found a place, we found a man, we've disposed of him, but he'll have to be taken care of either tonight or whatever it is when you're doing your patrolling. We told him exactly on the map where to find his hide. And his comment was that, We've enough work on our own doing other jobs, we'll get the mortars to deal with it. So what he was going to do was going to organise a mortar stonk on the area where the Chinamen were.
What was your attitude towards the enemy? Did you ever feel sorry for them?
I had a lot of admiration for them, really, in terms of our side belittled them in a little bit of respect, in the fact that they thought they were North Koreans, they were Chinese, they were peasants, they didn't know how to do this, didn't know how to do that. The leaders, the commissars and the leaders exhorted them to do all sorts of things. In fact, there was evidence that they were on, some of them were smoking opium cigarettes and things like this, evil-smelling cigarettes. So when they came out on patrol, They were having to be driven out on patrol, and people were blaming bureaus on these big pushes and that they had, these company and platoon attacks that would be announced by blowing of trumpets and very flares going up. All that sort of thing was a means of inducing the Chinamen to shoot. But my experience and my observations have been that they were equally as good at patrolling and camouflage as what we were. There was credit due to them in that respect. But not like our British soldiers, when they got the chance to relax and not have to take any sort of action or particular action against their own safety or anything, they just relaxed and just behaved like our British soldiers would do.
How did snipers get on with the rest of the soldiers in the battalion? How were they regarded by the rest of the battalion?